Thank you for tuning in to the Starkey Multifamily Podcast. I have with me Kent Ritter, who just recently closed in October on a 250-unit apartment deal. So we're going to talk about how he got there and what his plans are for the future. So thanks for joining us, Kent.
Yeah, Reed, thanks for having me. I appreciate you bringing me on the show.
Yeah, let's dig in. So let's start with the beginning of your real estate career. What made you get into real estate and where did it go from there?
Real estate's not something I've been involved in for 10 or 15 years. It's something I've gotten involved in really in the past 3 years. And before that, I was a management consultant. I worked with large health systems, billion-dollar plus primarily organizations throughout the country, helped them navigate financial issues and operational issues and really become more efficient, and also helped them with large system implementations. So build a company around that, really a boutique consulting firm, and exited that in 2015. My partners and I decided it was the right time to sell and to pursue something else. So I really, from there, started looking at, you know, what else is out there. I've got some capital now through that exit and wanted to decide what the right thing was. So, you know, I looked at a bunch of different options. I looked at franchising and buying a small business or starting another business, and landed on real estate is where I really thought would be the best way for me to continue to build my capital, build my wealth, and allow me to also have lead the lifestyle that I want to lead as an entrepreneur. So led to real estate, and luckily I was connected with some great people that were involved in many different aspects. So I started with, you know, doing some private lending, started buying some single families, did some private lending on some commercial deals, did some industrial investments, and really through that and this learning process landed on multifamily. And I felt like multifamily was the right place to be. Felt like it was the right time in the market to be in multifamily, and multifamily's treated me really well. So that's where I focus all of my time on now. And it really began my multifamily career through a series of passive investments. You know, I realized that there's a lot out there I didn't know. I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn from some good operators. So I found some operators out there that were doing syndications, made some investments with them, did about 10 investments, and really used that as a learning experience, used that as a way to really cut my teeth, kind of, you know, see the deal, understand how it works, and get a lot of questions answered. And through that, it was about a 2-year process of just being a part of those deals, asking questions, learning why they're doing the things that they're doing, understand, you know, what I liked about each operator's process, what I didn't like. And after a while and educating myself, realized this is something I felt like I could really do on my own, and I could be a lead sponsor, and I could take what I learned and do the things I liked and not do the things that I didn't like, and really provide investors with a positive experience and provide education along the way, and also provide a really good return. And it was a way for me to keep deploying my capital as well. So, you know, I really look at the process as I'm investing my own money, and I want to provide people the opportunity to invest alongside me in deals that I think are really strong and are going to provide a good return.
So when you started getting into the passive investing, what are some things that you looked for in a deal from your perspective?
Sure. Well, I mean, first it was returns, right? So I can kind of start with the returns and what do we think, what do we think those returns are going to be? And what I realized though was that pretty much all the returns, whether you're looking at it from an IRR, a cash on cash standpoint, if you look across operators, they all fall in about the same range, right? Like almost everybody I've seen is saying, okay, you're going to get, you know, a 15 or right around a 15 IRR. You're going to get, you know, 8 to 10% cash on cash. And so I started saying, okay, well, everybody's saying about the same thing. So then what's really the difference from one deal to another? And that's what led me to start to dig deeper and start to ask questions and start to really understand underwriting. And I spent a lot of time educating myself on underwriting, how to underwriting my own deals. So then I could be educated enough to ask the right questions to make sure that those returns were highly likely, and you know, that there was actually some meat behind them. So asking those questions around, you know, what assumptions are they making around rent growth and interest rates and you know, the market that they're in, and where's the property located? Why do they like the market? And you know, just all those different aspects that can, the reversion cap rate, for example, and learning what that was and how they calculate it, how they use it, and start asking, you know, why it is what it is, why they say there are, because those can really drive different return predictions for a deal. So just asking those questions, understanding the underwriting myself to a level where I could really evaluate a property and understand whether I thought the sponsor's numbers were accurate is really what I focused on initially. And then as I got into more deals, it was really more about what I realized was so important is, you know, the investor relationship is important. How do they communicate with investors? But more importantly, how do they manage the day-to-day? Because that's where I started to understand that's where deals can really fall apart, right? So how in the day-to-day process are they managing the property manager? What KPIs are they tracking? What are their leading indicators? How are they knowing when things start to go off the rails before things get really bad, right? And the more sophisticated syndicators really have processes set up to be able to do that. And so that became really important to me, really understanding their systems and their processes. And that also helped me to learn and be able to take those things and recreate those things in my own process.
Can you give me some examples of, you know, what the difference between a good systems and bad systems would be, you know, as far as following up the examples you gave, like following up with the property manager and things like that?
Sure. So I think that just having, having a system in place at all is great, but I think you have to have a rhythm. I think you have a rhythm like anything else with a property manager. So for example, you're meeting with them on at least a weekly basis. You have a scorecard that you've defined ahead of time that they're reporting out on. And you're tracking key performance indicators related to, you know, things like leases and bad debt. And you understand kind of what's coming down the pipeline. And making sure that you're not going to get into a point where, you know, all of a sudden you have vacancies coming that you didn't expect because your leasing pipeline wasn't full. So kind of looking ahead upstream at that funnel and be able to track that through, and then making sure that you know, from a budgeting perspective, that the budget's set and that they're on track to the budget. You know, you're looking at it from both a revenue and expense standpoint, and that that there's just no surprises. I think the consistency is what's most important. Consistency and following the same metrics and following them over time is what's going to tell you the story.
There's lots of coaching there, but there really isn't a whole plethora of information on building that system once you own the building. So what would you say would be your biggest piece of advice to somebody just closing on their first deal and going into it?
That's a good question. I think the first, you know, I think putting together a plan for kind of the first week, the first 30 days, and then kind of like almost like the first 100 days, kind of like the president does. You know, I think having those plans in place and understanding what your goals are and what are the things that are really going to drive value for your property, right? So understanding how are you going to communicate the turnover to the tenants, right? And understanding how you're going to, you know, especially in that initial phase, how are you going to, you know, evaluate the performance of the property manager? I think the first couple of months, first 3 months especially, are critical, because if you don't stay on top of things, you could see a dip in performance. It's going to follow you the rest of the life of the property when you hold that asset. You're going to be kind of digging yourself out of a hole. So I think having a really solid plan in place, I think getting your checklists in place, understanding all the things that need to be taken care of, making sure that you've been working with the property manager ahead of time. I mean, the property manager should be involved through the due diligence process and all the way through the close, so that you already have these plans and systems in place. And it's not something that you're talking about day one when you own the property. Okay, now what are we going to do, right? It's everybody knows where they need to be and what they need to do on day one. They need to know where they need to be and what they need to do on day seven, on day 30, you know, on day 100. Right. And I think that's the important thing, is just have those plans in place and make sure that you're over communicating and everybody's on the same page. And then I think from the investor side, it's important that you bring the investors along in that journey too. I mean, you don't want to show how all the sausage is made, but you want to bring them along in the process. Again, you want to communicate so that they get a sense of security. They get a sense that things are under control, because when you don't communicate, I mean, people tend to just go, their minds tend to just go to a negative place, right? If they don't hear from you, they think, oh, you know, what's going on? They're not doing anything. it's easy to stay out in front of that. Just communicate, let people know what's going on. And the thing I really like about that aspect is I use that aspect as education as well. Say, here's what we're doing and here's why we're doing it, and explaining that and talking through that and hosting, even hosting webinars at the beginning to kind of go through the process, whether monthly or quarterly, I think it'd be really valuable for the investors.
Yeah, I agree with you that communication is very critical. And I see a lot of people in the beginning, they get stuck on that. You know, like something goes, you and I both know that every deal has something go wrong. It just is going to happen. And the difference is whether or not you say, hey, there's a problem and we're working on it. Here's some solutions that we're trying to implement. And that makes you feel very comfortable as a passive investor when your money's in there and you say, okay, there's a problem, but they have a plan and they're working on it.
No, I completely agree with you. And I think that's a perspective I got from being a passive investor first and really, you know, feeling that and knowing that didn't feel good, right? And not knowing that I made this large investment and not knowing what was going on with my money, right? Essentially. So I think the communication and, like you said, identifying, you know, being upfront and saying, yeah, we have a problem, but here's the plan that's in place. Here's what we're doing to fix it. You know, it's like, reminds me of like, you know, if you're waiting for an airplane, right? Or you're waiting and your flight's delayed and you know, you sit there for hours and hours and the airlines don't say anything, right? Mm-hmm. And people, you start to see the worst in people in that situation, which it's a very different environment if they come on, they just say, hey, look, here's what's going on. We're trying our best to fix it. We'll give you an update in 15 minutes, right? And continue to do that process. I mean, I used to fly a lot as a consultant, and you notice that that really kind of calms the herd, if you will, if it's just regular communication.
Yeah, I had it explained to me one time. The guy said, well, it starts with a small problem happens, and in your mind you say, well, I'm just going to fix this and nobody has to know about it. And then not all problems get fixed right away. And then It grows. But then by the time you realize you're in trouble, you're too far into it to really say, hey, I should have told you 3 months ago when this problem started. But So it kind of grows on itself. That's how it was explained to me. And I think knowing that ahead of time, knowing that, hey, when something's small, it's okay to say, hey, we got a small problem, and then you fix it. Because then they know you got like a warm, fuzzy feeling, like you said. You know they're telling you all the stuff. Mm-hmm. So you know when something bad happens, you can feel comfortable that at least you know what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think things are always going to happen, right? Like no deal goes perfect. If they all did, this would be a lot easier than it is, right? And a lot more people would do it. I mean, the whole reason that we're able to do what we do is because we're able to solve problems. I mean, that's essentially what we're doing, right? We're solving a problem that maybe someone else couldn't or didn't have the skill set to do. And because we're able to solve those problems, we're able to create opportunities. And so it really, each project is just a series of solving problems, and you continue to do that through the entire process.
Yeah, that's a great point. So you did 10 passive investing deals, and then you somehow got into this latest deal, the 250 unit syndication. Tell me how that happened, because you had some partners on the deal. How did that team form, how did you get into that?
Yeah, so the team formed through networking. I mean, I think we all met through Joe Fairless, actually, and through his program, and continued to build relationships, and then decided that it made sense to partner up. Just all the things came together for the deal. You know, I live in Indianapolis, and I actively look around my home. I look in Indiana and Ohio and in Kentucky primarily, but I don't really look outside of kind of a 2 hour driving radius around my house. So I realized that there's other markets and other markets that are having great growth and other markets that I wanted to be a part of. So, you know, I also made it a point to look for people in those markets, Atlanta being one of them, and build relationships because that gives me access to those areas. And so that's really how the partnership came about. And because, you know, a partner located in Atlanta, and they had an opportunity that they came across, and it was larger than what they could, you know, what they could take down themselves from a work standpoint, from a capital standpoint. So decided that it made sense to partner up and do the deal together. And it was a, it was a fantastic opportunity for me, being able to go through that process and do that process with folks that were experienced syndicators and have been through the process a few times, and being able to really learn. You know, I had learned a ton from being a passive investor, but there's so much you learn through actually going through the deal as a sponsor, and that's just invaluable. You know, you don't know it until you do it.
Yeah, so I think that's a great story because it points to many things that I believe in strongly. So, you know, number one, you don't have to take the whole thing down yourself. That's what syndication is it's working together with people. So you found people doing essentially what you wanted to get into and brought to the table your strengths, and it worked perfectly. So I think that's a great story. You know, I think so many people think that you have to do this all by yourself, start to finish, and really it can be done, but it certainly is not easy to do by yourself. So
yeah, that's definitely, that was my mindset for a long time. You know, I just wanted to kind of be the hero, just do it all and get it done. But it's definitely not the most efficient way to do it, and it's definitely not it's not the way to do it with the least stress either. It's so nice to be able to split up the job duties, split up the responsibilities, have folks that you can rely on, and you can just get so much more done that way as well. I mean, and you know, you build off each other's strengths, you learn from each other, and I think that's one of the things I love about real estate, especially multifamily, especially the networks that I'm involved in, because everyone is so open and willing to share and to talk about what they've done and to partner, you know, just grow together. Like I think it's a fantastic community of like really positive, like-minded people, and it's fun to interact with. And so it's one nice thing. I think it's a nice thing about being an entrepreneur is you can decide who you want to work with. You don't have to work with people you don't like. You know, you're not stuck in a cube next to a guy that you can't stand or, you know, eats tuna for every day for lunch. Mm-hmm. You just get to work with people you enjoy working with, and you all get to grow together. I think it's a very much network of people with an abundance mentality.
Yeah. So you came into the deal, was it already under contract at that point, or did you decide to work with them prior to that?
It was just they had just gotten it under contract, and we decided, you know, they presented it to me, we talked through it, and decided that, yeah, it made a lot of sense. So yeah, it was under contract. It was kind of early on in the process.
So tell me, your role is primarily on the capital raising side, correct? And then investor relations and now asset management?
Yeah, primarily. Yeah, that's exactly right. So yeah. So from a capital raiser side, you know, and then yeah, working through investor relations, ongoing investor communication, you know, sending out deal updates as things are happening, you know, being a point of communication, and making sure that, like we said, the investors, you know, maintain that good feeling that they understand what's going on and that we're transparent about the property. And then yeah, and then from an asset management standpoint, you know, we're somewhat asset managing by committee in that we are getting together and, you know, reviewing the business plan, making sure we're still in line with our strategy, understanding where adjustments need to be made, and putting everyone's heads together to make sure that, you know, we maintain the best plan going forward, and that we're nimble enough to be able to move as we need to, as we said, problems come up.
Yeah. So how was this, the syndication structured? Was it a 506B or C?
506B.
Okay. So, so you had a network previously coming into this, to raise money. Had you done things to grow your network prior to this, or was it people that you had known, or how did you get that network?
Yeah. So largely this deal, was all folks that I knew previously. I mean, it has to be folks, you know, previously, but I mean, prior to real estate. So folks that I had, number of folks I went to college with, another number of folks I've friends with from back when I lived in Chicago, and then some folks that I, used to work with as well in my old consulting days. So yeah, it was interesting. I think the one thing that I didn't really understand before I started trying to raise capital was that, especially, it's actually easier to raise money from folks that you don't have a pre-existing relationship with, I think, in many ways. I mean, there are folks that, you know, will trust you and will just invest in it because because they trust you and they trust you, and they may not know about the deal, but they trust you, right? Mm-hmm. But what I found was a lot of people, they had a pre-existing idea of who I was, right? Maybe they knew me in high school, they knew me in college, they knew me as a new consultant, or they knew me, you know, in any number of ways, but they didn't know me as a real estate investor and as someone that they would, you know, trust to give money to. So I really had to work hard to change the perception of those people and really elevate myself through showing my knowledge and showing what I've done, and you know, coming to people in a very professional way to give them the confidence that they can invest their money with me.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I'd like to dig into that a little deeper. Is, you know, sometimes, you know, so your first deal, you might be asking how much you raised on it.
Sure. Yeah. So I raised about 500,000.
So, I mean, that's quite a bit. So you had quite a few people, probably, you know, at least, you know, maybe 5 to 10 people involved in that.
Yeah.
And getting over that, you know, so you were known as, you know, the business consulting, guy first, right? And then, so now you're saying, hey, I'm a real estate guy. I want you to trust me. How did you break that barrier or get through to them, you know, that you knew what you were doing in this field, and that you were somebody to trust?
Yeah. The first thing, really started with just educating, you know, none of the folks that invested with me in that first deal had a background in real estate or had ever invested in real estate before. So it really had to start with, okay, why should they invest in real estate? You know, and so I put together a presentation, like any good consultant would. You know, I had a PowerPoint, put together my presentation on, you know, why real estate's a great idea. What are all the benefits? You know, why multifamily is a great idea. You know, what are all the benefits? Why large apartments are a great idea. You know, why going big is better than going small. Why it's better to invest in a large apartment alongside me rather than go out and buy a single family home. Right. And put all those pieces together. Cause really, I found that was the first hurdle. And then, okay, once they said, okay, real estate's a good idea. Yeah. All of that is a good idea. I get that. But you know, why you're just getting started. Right. I found that a lot of the skills that I developed as a consultant really, parlayed nicely into real estate. You know, I worked with in the healthcare space, but I worked with large health systems, many a billion-dollar plus organizations, and help them advising CFOs primarily on how to improve their processes, you know, to improve their financials, increase revenue, reduce costs, build systems, implement technology. A lot of these things that really parlay into real estate, right? You think about running an apartment and building systems, right? And reducing costs and managing vendors, managing people. Like I said, my old business, we had 95 employees. So just managing that process. I find that if you have you may not have real estate experience, but you have previous business experience, a lot of that translates, like I said, managing change, putting in systems and managing people. If you can do those things, you can most likely be successful in real estate. So I found that really hitting on those points, along with showing my real estate education and the work that I've done. And that really helped get people over the line. I think the other big thing was the mentorship. So showing that I had mentors in place to advise me, to act as my backstop, and to help me avoid making those newbie mistakes. So I think that gave people a lot of confidence. You know, I kind of say, you know, I have mentors in place because if they tell me that the stove is hot, I don't have to touch the stove myself. Right. Yeah. I'm smart enough to listen and say, okay, I'm not going to go there. So yeah, I think those things came together, and I got enough people to trust in me in that first deal. And luckily we were able to get in that. And now we just made our first distribution just 3 months after we acquired the property, and we're making monthly distributions here on out.
That's awesome. Yeah. So let's talk about some of the, so we talked about the raising the money, and let's get into the due diligence part. I don't know how involved you were in that aspect of it, but things always come up. So let's talk about some challenges that came up on the deal and how you dealt with those.
Yeah. So the due diligence was pretty straightforward. A couple of things came up in the deal, and towards the end, really, we had the way our financing was set up is we did 60-day close, but then we had a 30-day extension, and luckily we had the 30-day extension because we executed that. We had a couple things come up. The biggest one was we actually found out that the owner had reported the occupancy as higher than what it actually was, and we found that out about a couple of weeks before close, and kind of at the 11th hour, my partners were able to negotiate a $100,000 discount on the property due to that. So, you know, I think just staying on the due diligence till the end, dotting all the I's, crossing all the T's, doing the final checks on things like occupancy, really helped us, get a nice credit and get into the deal at a little bit lower basis. So I think that's my lesson learned from due diligence is, don't stop checking on things till the end until the ink dries.
So where did the discrepancy come up? So were you doing like a lease audit, or how did you find that discrepancy?
Yeah, I think it just came out of, it was after we did initial lease audits, and I think it came out of just tracking the reporting. I think there was another, I don't know the exact location. I think there was another report that came out as we were asking for the numbers up until the end. And then I think just being on site at the property and talking with the property manager, I think there were discrepancies as we saw the report versus speaking in person with the folks and what was going on.
So there was a property manager and an owner. So both those people would have to be involved in that. Was it something that was accidental, just an overlook on their part, or, how does that come to be?
I think so. I mean, I think it was probably accidental. It's hard to say, but I think it was probably an oversight, and it was something that, when identified, they were able to rectify, and we were able to come to a good conclusion.
Fair enough. So you've got the deal closed. You got the 30-day extension, which is pretty standard. And you're able to close at a price that's agreeable. So now you've got the deal in place, which you said you've already made distributions on. So how is that process going? What have you learned from that?
I think the process is going smoothly. It's a standard value add process. Really, we have the property manager running the renovations, and we're putting about $5,000 into each unit. The plan is to renovate almost all the units. Out of 250, we're renovating about 245, five of which were already renovated. So going through the whole process over about 2 years, and it started off smoothly. There's already, I don't know the exact number right now, but we already have about 8 units renovated at this point, and we've been able to stay a little ahead of schedule. So everything's gone well. We're doing a fairly standard renovation, floors, walls, countertops, keeping cabinets where possible, new kitchen hardware, lighting package, and things like that. But it's all cosmetic in nature. The thing we really liked about this property was that it was stabilized property. I mean, they're nicer buildings. They're B-class properties in good areas with high-income individuals. It's white-collar areas, and the properties really didn't have any deferred maintenance. There was a couple of small things, but we were able to spend our CapEx where it really matters, not on fixing things that weren't going to improve our ability to raise rents. So it's really cosmetic. And there's some light value add on the exterior, mainly things like landscaping.
When you did the value add, so did you use those 5 units for self-comping, or did you go by the market, or how did you determine where you wanted to get the rents to?
So we did some self-comping with the 5 units, but we discounted it knowing that it's only 5 units, right? So we were able to look at that, which was great. That gave us one point of reference, but then really doing the market survey was how we identified where we thought we could go. And then in our underwriting, because we wanted to be conservative, they really kept it, there was a $160 variance from where we were to the market. And as we underwrote on one of the buildings, because there's a 2 property portfolio. I don't know if I mentioned that, but one of the properties, $100, on the other property, $125. So we still left a gap up to where the renovated units were actually achieving, because we didn't want to underwrite to say that we'd be able to achieve that 160 on every unit, just because 5 out of 250 wasn't a large enough sample.
I think that's a key for anybody who's underwriting and kind of learning how to underwrite is you see different people, and you know, we could have mentioned this a little bit when we talked about from a passive investor. Mm-hmm. You know, I've talked with other people. I said, I can give you returns of anything you want on paper.
Right.
You know, you tell me what you want. I can make it happen. But the truth of the matter is, how did I look at different numbers? So if you had used that 160 number, you know, you could have paid probably easily $500,000 to $1 million more.
Right.
But that's not realistic to assume that everything's going to go just as planned. If it does, that's fantastic, but it's maybe a little bit unrealistic. And you see some people who are like, oh yeah, you know, I seen this property that has, you know, more amenities, but I think I can get that rent, and you know, I can sell this place for $80,000 a door when nothing has sold over 50 a door,
right,
you know, or something like that. But so yeah, I think that's a great point that you talk about that conservative approach on different numbers, because nothing is perfect, and you just can't get perfect. So
yeah, I think that's critical. I think that's critical, right? I mean, I see a lot of people that tout how many acquisitions they've made, right, in a certain year, for example. And I think that's a great achievement, but it also just tells me that you're able to pay the highest price, right? So I think you have to be careful with that, right? Because it's not just about the fact that you're able to acquire. It's, did you acquire at a price that's actually going to allow you to hit your numbers and get the returns that you're expecting, because they were realistic, right? So there's, you know, areas that, you know, in this deal we were conservative, and that I always look to be conservative, being, you know, what's the premium on rent after renovation, right? What's the CapEx going to be, and do you have a contingency in your CapEx? So I like to underwrite a 5% or 10% just contingency for those things that are unknown that happen, right? Your organic rent growth. So are you, you know, for example, Atlanta, for the past few years, the organic rent growth has been 4.5% to 5% in some areas, but we underwrote at 3%. So we said, does this deal still work if things revert back to a more normal state of affairs, right? We understand things aren't going to grow at 5% forever. So, you know, doing things like that, and the reversion cap rate, which we talked about before, right? So the cap rate on your exit, you know, are you predicting that it's going to be below, at, or above the cap rate when you purchased? Well, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but a lot of people believe that cap rates are fairly compressed at this point, and that likely in the future, cap rates are going to expand. So we underwrote a fairly typical benchmark of, on one of the properties, of 10 basis points per year, so 50 basis points in a 5-year hold. So if we're in at a 5.5, we're exiting at a 6 cap. And on the other property, we actually did 75 basis points just to be a little more conservative. So just based on location versus the other property, because they're about 30 minutes apart. So, but I think those are areas that are, like you said, can drastically change your numbers and can give you whatever number you want on paper. But the question is, how realistic are they, and are they conservative, right? So I think we've built multiple areas where even if things don't play out exactly like we want, we've built in cushions in 4 or 5 areas that we still think we'll be able to overachieve our numbers.
That's awesome. So you mentioned 5 years. Is that the exit plan on this, is 5 years?
It is. Exit plan is 5 years.
So you have, so what financing did you end up getting for that?
So we actually did a Fannie loan, but we did 10-year fixed. Again, just to be conservative. I mean, we underwrote it at 5 years as kind of a standard and a way to look at apples to apples, but we wanted to get 10-year debt because we wanted to have the interest rate protection, and we wanted to have the flexibility. The other thing that we did on the property was separated. It was a portfolio, like I said. So we separated the two properties into separate LLCs and separate loans, so that we could run the properties independently and then allow us to sell the properties independently if that was the most advantageous thing to do versus having to sell as a portfolio. So we did multiple things through the financing to set it up to just be most advantageous and to give us the most flexibility. Because if, you know, if we get to year 5 and we're at the end of a recession, while our business plan says that's the time to sell, we didn't want to be forced to sell at the bottom of a recession, right? We wanted to have that flexibility, and we wanted to also have the flexibility to maybe sell one property at year 5, or if we go through and hit our numbers in 3 years, sell one property in year 3 or both. But just giving us the flexibility to make the, you know, to be in the best position to make the decision that's going to give the best returns for our investors.
So having two properties, that's interesting, or two separate loans. Now, was there additional cost to having the two loans set up? I assume you got two different closing costs now.
Yeah, there were, but I mean, it was, you know, it's fairly menial. It wasn't, you know, we felt that that doing it that way and not having them cross collateralized was going to be more beneficial than the additional cost. I mean, it's the same, if you think about it, it's the same thing from a prepayment penalty standpoint, because on a 10-year loan, the payment penalty is yield maintenance. So if we were to sell in year five, there'll be some prepayment penalties, but again, we model that out and understand what we think that potentially could look like. And, you know, if we feel that selling in year five is still going to make sense, even with the prepayment penalties, then we'll do that. You know, I know a lot of people that have sold apartments early, and paid back prepayment penalties because they don't care, because they're still making a couple million dollars and they're still giving their returns to their investors. So, you know, I think it's all about, it's all just about managing your risk, right? So we felt that the most prudent thing to do was to put a 10-year fixed debt on it, get the 3 years of interest only up front, but then have that flexibility to hold for the long term if things did turn south, and just hold it in cash flow and be happy doing that, and then sell at the most advantageous time. And we were in at such a low interest rate. We were in right almost at the bottom, about 3.64%. So we knew that from a yield maintenance perspective, in all likelihood, interest rates were going to be higher, you know, as we went to exit. So we felt that the yield maintenance penalty would be minimized.
Yeah, 3.64. That's pretty good. So did you get interest only on that at all, or was it just straight?
3 years. Yeah, 3 years interest only.
And then, that's a pretty good deal. I didn't realize it had gotten quite down that low. I've been hearing like 3.9, but 3.6, that's the lowest I've heard so far.
Yeah, it moved down about 25 basis points through that extension that we had to execute. So it was,
fantastic.
Some things are just lucky. Mm-hmm. It was all about timing.
You know, that's an interesting point too, to talk about being conservative in writing, is that is the financing, because you never know. It can change for the good, but it can also change for the bad. And that can really bite you. If you were depending on getting X percent and it goes up, you know, 50 basis points, like you said, or down 50 basis points, that really changes your numbers quite a bit.
Yeah. And I think that happened to a lot of people at the end of 2018, you know, mm-hmm. when rates jumped all of a sudden, a lot of deals got killed, because that's exactly what happened. So when we underwrote it at 3.9. I think we were originally at 4, and then we saw where things were going and we got our initial quotes. We dropped it to 3.9, which is still above our initial quotes. But again, you know, we had that extra cushion. So, you know, we wouldn't have to, the deal wouldn't fall apart if interest rates moved in the wrong direction.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you've got the 5-year hold, we've got the value add. So it seems like you got everything in place. Do you see anything else mentioning on that property worth talking about?
No, I think that's about it. I think that, you know, the only other thing I'd say about Atlanta is I think Atlanta is a great market. But there's also, Atlanta is one of those cities where there's just a ton of local developers. There's a lot of supply being built. I think that's the other thing to talk about we didn't mention is, you know, one of the biggest drivers are the supply and demand dynamics. And so just making sure that when you're evaluating a deal, whether you're a passive investor or you're active, is, you know, what are those supply and demand dynamics in your environment? Because that's the thing that's going to drive, you know, the performance of your property more than anything else, I think, is, you know, is if a bunch of supply is coming online, all of a sudden there's a lot more competition for your product. And you have to be careful, and you have to understand that. So Atlanta is one of those places where a ton of apartments are always being built. So if you can find properties that are more infill and not on the periphery, I think that's critical, because there's a higher barrier to entry, right? They can't just pop up a 400 unit apartment right down the street from you. So, you know, I think it's something to consider and something that we looked at and something we felt fairly protected on based on the location of our current property. But I think it's something that people need to make sure they're taking into account, is understanding, you know, what's coming online in the next couple of years, and looking at that as you start to evaluate properties.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I never thought about the location of interior to the city and exterior, but that makes sense. You know, you can't build in the city very easily, but you can certainly build in the outskirts very mm-hmm. easily. So that's a great point. So Kent, what's next in your future? Where are you going?
Yeah. So right now it's all about rinsing and repeating, right? It's, we put the systems in place, you know, got the first deal done, and it's really about finding additional opportunities. And for me, it's, continuing to get my message out there, continuing to build my thought leadership platform. You know, my goal of 2020 is to start my own podcast and start my own YouTube channel. So I'm going to be starting a YouTube channel called, Simplified Real Estate, just focused on, you know, short clips, 5-7 minute videos on specific real estate concepts, just laying it out in layman's terms for folks to help investors understand what they're getting into. That really came out of my first experience raising money when, you know, I started with having to explain to people a lot of what it was we were talking about before they could even evaluate if it was the deal they wanted to be in. So helping people get that education in a bite-sized format. And then a podcast, just to continue to get out there and have conversations like this. I enjoy educating on real estate and talking about real estate. I run a meetup in Indianapolis focused on multifamily, and it's a great time. And then just continue to find deals and meet new investors. That's really the goal for 2020, is really scaling up the business.
Yeah, I'll have to reach out to you and get you the information on that meetup, and we'll put it on there.
Yeah,
and when you get that. When you get the YouTube channel up and fired up, we'll give me a shout, and we'll do a little quick promotion for you.
Oh, I appreciate that, Reed. That'd be great, man.
Yeah. So Kent, tell everybody, how can they get a hold of you now, and where can they reach out to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now, the easiest way to get a hold of me, is, you know, LinkedIn. A lot of people find me through LinkedIn. It's Kent Ritter. Really easy to find on LinkedIn. Facebook, the same way, Kent Ritter. Or you can reach out to me via email at kent@hudsoninvesting.com. It's HUDSON investing.com. So those are the best ways to find me.
Great. I wish you the best of luck, and congratulations on the 250 units.
Thanks, Reed. Have a good rest of the day, man.
All right. Thanks.